Research So this year, in 2022, we're starting and experimenting with a few mini-series. And as part of the experience, we have new co-host Sue. The future of is how we plan to describe this particular series where we chat about big ideas with Singaporeans engaged in social initiatives in Asia and beyond. Our co-host is Samantha Lee, the founding partner of Stonetook Partners, an early-stage fund that invests in companies in emerging markets in Africa and Southeast Asia. And she's going to introduce the episode and our guest before taking the lead on the questions.
Hi everyone, I'm Samantha. So today we'll be talking about Water Roam and its founder, Chong Tee. So social enterprise Water Roam has been working to build a world without prolonged thirst. They've been deployed in 38 countries, working with over 50 humanitarian organizations to impact hundreds of thousands of lives. And today with one of its co-founders, Lim Chong Tee, we want to push the conversation a little further by challenging him to share his big ideas about the future of water and addressing water scarcity. After that, we talk about Water Roam's plans in the next 5 years and then the next 50 years before rounding up with his personal development and his thoughts on the social political situation in Myanmar, especially in relation to the work of the growing social enterprise.
Welcome to the podcast, Chong Tee. So maybe to start us off, tell us a little about Water Roam and the work you do at the social enterprise.
Hi, Tingyao. I'm Chong Tee, and my social enterprise is called Water Roam. We design innovative water solutions that's catered for disaster relief as well as rural areas. We also have a sub-brand called Water Roam Home, and we produce basically household products for urban homes and families. And our goal is to build a world without prolonged thirst, and we want to do so through technology and innovation and really understanding what are the needs of people on the ground.
Great, thanks for the introduction. So before our chat today, we invited you to think about the future of water and water scarcity. And you came up with three big ideas in response. Could you tell us more about your first idea, which is around changing our mindset on water scarcity? Are scientists fear-mongering, or is water really that scarce?
Yeah, I think before I jump into the idea of the first idea, I want to talk a little bit about the current water situation in the world. We are actually kind of in a little bit of global water crisis, as much as most of us don't really feel it, because I think right now when we turn on the taps, water flows out of our pipes for most of us. And there's this illusion of very bountiful access. But if you actually look at some of the global statistics on how much water is actually available, you will realize that this illusion is actually a very fragile system. So in the world right now, if you look at Earth, right, it's mostly like blue. And that's because like it's majority water, right? But out of all this water, only about 1% is actually fresh water that we can drink. 97% of it is salt water. And then you have 2% of it, which is frozen in the, frozen in the ice caps. So out of this 1% of fresh water, you have surface water and groundwater. But about two-thirds or more than two-thirds of it is actually hidden in the aquifers underground. So they're actually really hard to access for people. And for groundwater, they actually take millennia to top up. These are basically water in the rocks, in the sand, in the clay. And often at the time we extract this water from the ground because we want to provide water to places where it is not really available, and like surface water is not really available around them. But over extraction of water can actually cause a lot of problems. Like one of them is that it will cause the land to get compressed, and it can cause the land to sink. And if you look at Indonesia right now, they are facing, especially in Jakarta, where they're over-extracting water for industrial and agricultural use. The land is actually sinking. The other issue with groundwater is actually that it is actually really like our savings account. And if we really deplete that savings account, we will have a lot of problems. So you think about it, we have about 1% of fresh surface water that is accessible to us. And we really need to be very, very cautious about how we use them. For developed societies like Singapore and the US or most developed countries, you consume up to about 65 to 140 liters of water per day. And all of this 140 or 100 liters of water, about 60 liters of water is what we consider basic requirements for subsistence, right? So you think about what is needed for basic human rights, you know, for drinking, for cooking, for showering, for hygiene. We require about 60 liters of it. But you realize that, you know, in our habits and all that, we are rather wasteful of water, because I think we don't really appreciate how scarce water is. So I think going to our first idea, jumping into our first idea, we know that there's a lot of talks about water being very precious. You know, I grew up with that. But I think sometimes there's also this, you know, when we hear it so much, we kind of get desensitized to it. And sometimes we wonder if, like, are scientists just fear-mongering? Are they just peddling fear? And is it really that scarce? And, you know, based on the introduction I have, right, you know that water is really a very precious resource. If you realize throughout human history, when water is accessible, civilizations thrive. And when droughts happen, you know, the water scarcity breeds conflict, and that's where a lot of civilization falls. So, for example, you look at the Mayan civilization, you know, they started growing really rapidly when they built its first reservoir, its paved reservoir system in the 500 BCE. But a 100-year drought that happened from about, I think, 800 to 900 BCE completely annihilated the society, right? And obtaining clean water has always been a very defining struggle in human history. And often of times, like, we don't really treasure how precious water is, and it is not really reflective of the current situation we have globally. So I think we need to be very mindful about how fragile the system actually is, and, you know, be very aware that water itself, clean water itself, is very important. And when you hear about news and reports about, you know, water being scarce or running low or being depleted, they're actually absolutely true. You know, it is not a myth. And we need to be able to see past that illusion.
Yeah, thanks for that. I mean, I'm based in California, and so droughts are pretty common here. And now that you told me that we only get 1% of all of its water, that makes me even more nervous. So definitely, thanks for sharing that. Yeah, so, you know, after providing an introduction to why water is so important and how scarce it is, I'd love to hear more about your second idea, which is valuing the true worth of water.
Yeah, so the first idea I had was about changing our mindset about how we see water, right? To see it as it is. I think the second part is to be able to value the worth of water, right? Given the accessibility of water we have, you know, we talk about the preciousness of water, adding a lot of times just as much, mostly as a lip service, I feel. Few truly understand the impact of water running out. So if you remember a few years back in South Africa, they were close to experiencing a day zero. A day zero is a day where, you know, water runs out from the pipes, and then, you know, you won't have water anymore. So it actually descended into a huge chaos, and people started, like, saving water like crazy. People started rationing water like crazy. And near the end of it, I think South Africa was really lucky. It rained. And also because of the people's efforts of conservation, they were able to avoid a day zero. But this day zero could happen to California, it could happen to China, it could happen to Singapore, it could happen anywhere. Because right now, we are living in a system where climate change is actually affecting the water that we have. So to think about how we can value the true worth of water, one of the things that we can't avoid is actually to look at the price of water, right? Water is extremely valuable. So it's something that some people talk about water like it's the next goal, right? It's like the next goal for us. But the thing about goal is that, you know, sorry, goal or oil, you know, people talk about oil like it's goal, and water itself is like that, the same commodity. But the thing is that without oil, our cars stop moving and society pretty much get descend to chaos. But without water, we die, you know, like without water, we really die. So it is very important for us to put a value to water. So just like many people, you know, I'm often very frustrated with price hikes, with increase in taxes and GSTs. But just like many people, you know, people with big families and many people in the household, every dollar increase in water pains the family. But it is very important to look at the different kind of progressive payment structures we can use to reflect the value of water. So for example, you know, in Singapore, what we do to kind of show the value of water is through kind of pricing. You know, we segregate water use into industrial or enterprise users and also for domestic and portable use. And within every household, we'll find ways to provide clean water for municipal and sanitary purposes like flushing, right? So using water that is not so clean for flushing purposes, for example, is one way to reduce the amount of water we use. As much as water tariffs are unpopular, things like water tariffs, water conservation taxes, and water bond fees are unpopular, there are also ways that we can use actually to kind of reflect the true price of water. In many places in the world, I think the true price of water is often not reflected, right? But putting some of these tariffs and taxes actually, as much as they are unpopular, they kind of reflect the true price of water. And there can be systems put in place to make sure that, for example, people who are of the lower income brackets or from lower social economic class can still get their access to clean water. One of them is to look at, for example, every day a person will need basic 60 liters of water, for example. You know, that water can be subsidized heavily, you know, so that people can get their basic universal access to that water, their right to water. But anything that is maybe beyond a certain level, they'll have to pay a slightly higher price. So in Singapore, for example, they use some of these GST vouchers to help lower income families offset the price hikes. And I think some of the more progressive thoughts are about thinking about whether there is a need to put a wealth tax on water. It's kind of like food for thought for many of these governments that are trying to regulate the use of water right now. Because is it really fair for some other people to pay more for water when it's such a basic thing for people? But these different models are actually ways that, ways that can be integrated into countries to make sure that people still have the basic access to water, but those who can afford to pay a little bit more, pay slightly more for their part for clean water. So that is actually something that I feel is important in order for us to value the true worth of water.
I think it's really interesting that you approached it from, or rather you approached this big idea from a policy and nationwide stand view, because I think that's something that, you know, as individuals, we think about our small part, but we rarely think about it on a national wide level. So that I thought was really interesting. I think the other thing that also we'd love to hear more from you, especially in terms of given your work with Water Room, where you are leveraging innovation to solve the water crisis, you know, I would love to hear more about your third big idea, which is really to leverage more aggressively on innovation to solve this crisis.
Yeah, so I think apart from water scarcity, we should also talk about accessibility. You know, I think the first two ideas I talk about is about, the first one was changing our mindsets, you know, and recognizing it for what it is, that it is really very scarce and very, very precious to us. The second one is how we value it, to price it right, and for people to be able to understand that it is very valuable. The third one is actually to make use of innovation to solve the water crisis, using innovation to provide accessibility to everyone. As much as we are very lucky to, you know, wake up to a cup of clean water, about 2 billion people in the world, 2.2 billion in fact, do not have access to safely managed drinking water services. So safely managed drinking water services is a definition by WHO. Basically, it means that drinking water that is free of contamination, that is available at home when needed, and toilets where, you know, as treated can be disposed and treated safely. This is what we mean by safely managed water. So about 2 billion people in the world do not have access to safely managed water. And there's actually a lot of gaps in services between the urban areas and the rural areas. So for example, 2 out of 3 people with safely managed drinking water and 3 out of 5 people with safely managed sanitation services live in urban areas. And of about 160 million people using untreated surface water, about 150 of them live in rural areas. So basically, there is a very big need in rural developing regions and a lot of room for better technologies to be utilized in this area. And for me at Water Room, what we are doing is we are often looking at how we can create more decentralized tech that can be put into some of these rural areas so that these people who are drinking water that is not treated, that might potentially be contaminated, they can still drink the water safely. And I feel that Water Room is just doing one part of it. There's a lot more that could be done as well. And if you look at it from a macro perspective, you know, one of the ways that we are treating the issue of water scarcity is actually to use RO solutions and desalination solutions. So RO or reverse osmosis is basically a pressurized membrane process where you push salt water or high salinity water through membranes, and what you get is actually clean drinkable water. And over the last 10 years, over the last decade, our production of desalinated water all around the world have increased by about double. I believe the number is about 17 billion to about 33 billion meter cubes of water right now. But right now, the technology is still, I wouldn't say it is quite mature, but it is still not very accessible. Right now, for example, it is very energy intensive, and as a result, very, very costly. And there's also an issue of what we call the RO brine. You know, during desalination, you push out clean water, extremely pure and clean, extremely pure drinking water. But on the reject side, you actually get this extremely saline and extremely concentrated brine. And the issue with brine is that it's actually very costly and difficult to dispose of. It can cause environmental damage if it's not disposed of properly. So, for example, in Singapore's case, brine is actually safely discharged into a sewer system that is treated, you know, and they kind of meet within the regulatory standards. But in some cases where our systems are not used, or where government management systems are not so well managed, when the brine is disposed into the sea or into the lakes and the rivers, it can actually kill a lot of the marine life and actually affect the ecosystem, the environment around it. So there definitely can be more room to actually look at this area and think about what we can do to make these technologies better and more sustainable. So for example, what we do at WaterRoam is that we don't just focus on providing like the highest end solution, because it is not very accessible to some of the communities we work with, but we focus a lot on providing ultra filtration solutions, UF solutions. And in some other places, people provide nanofiltration solutions. So UF and NF are kind of, they are a membrane technology that is not as powerful as RO, because they can't remove everything in water. They can't remove saline water, but they can be very efficient in treating water that is not saline, for example. So you are kind of using the right solution and fitting them into the right places and solving the right problem with the most efficient technology. So using UF and NF is also a substitute to just using RO as a kind of one-size-fits-all solution, you know, and then you can still tackle the issue with water scarcity without spending a huge ton of money, without leveraging on huge and proper infrastructure. And if you're talking about leveraging on innovation, I think needless to say, we need to look at the food water energy nexus, because even though today's topic is on water, it is very important to look at other aspects of such energy, because even for water, you know, to transport it, to sometimes run it autonomously so that it can provide for larger populations, you actually need energy. And right now in many societies where we're getting our energy is from fossil fuels, it's from oil, it's from coal. For example, if you're using RO, you definitely need to use electricity. And if you're using oil and coal, not only are you creating an issue, environmental issue from the RO brine, you are also putting a lot of carbon into air just to make clean water, make salty water drinkable, right? So it's important to also invest a lot in the energy nexus to make sure that we can tap more into renewable resources, make sure that we can power our water sustainably. So things like wind energy, solar electrification, they are extremely essential to make sure that water is accessible for all. And at WaterRoam, what we do is that we make sure that our solution is highly compatible and complementary to renewable sources. So, for example, our pumps can be powered by a solar pump at very low pressures, which means that you are effectively not really creating a lot of carbon footprint, right? It's not leaving a very high carbon footprint from its processes. So I think leveraging on technology and using all these various innovations, combining them, using them appropriately will be ways that we can use to solve this water crisis.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting how you've highlighted how this is such an interconnected issue. It connects, it relates to other things like carbon footprint and like marine life, etc. So I always like to say that, there's a saying that goes that it takes a village to raise a child. And I always like to say that it takes a extensive community to solve a global problem. So, you know, for our listeners out there who might want to contribute to the future of water and share in your work of providing access to clean water for all, what advice do you have for them?
For everyone else who wants to do something for water, what you're saying? Yeah, so I think at the most basic level is what we do. I think for us, is in our daily habits. You know, if you are taking really, really long showers, think about, you know, just spending about maybe 5 to 7 minutes, you know, not more than 15 minutes when you're showering, or turn off the tap when you're showering. I know these are very basic things, but they're very important, because one of the most amount of water wasted is usually through these areas. I think in other areas, it's actually more in terms of areas like policy, I feel. As much as I think this is a bit further out of reach from us, we need to actually encourage governments to look at policies where we are using more energy efficient or making sure that industries are able to use more water conserving kind of technologies in their operations. So for example, not really for Singapore, but for many other places, one of the largest wastage of water is actually through leaking pipes, for example. It is very important to make sure that you know, we are able to make sure that the leaks are identified and that all this water are not wasted. And another area that we can do actually as individuals is through our consumption habits, actually. So for example, when we drink a can of Coke, for example, like a 350 ml can of Coke, even though it's just maybe like a 350 ml bottle, about 35 liters of water is put into producing it. So the ingredients for Coke will take about 28 liters of water to process, right? And about 7 liters of it goes into packaging. And the same thing goes to something like a quarter pounder, for example. When we eat a quarter pounder, we're paying like maybe $10 for it. But it takes about 15,000 of liters to actually process the meat, the beef, you know, and to feed the cattle, right? So being cautious about what we buy and what we eat will actually affect the amount of, will kind of affect the amount of water that we consume. Right now, about 70% of our global water use is actually from agriculture, right? And a lot of it is actually going to livestock, because like we're using alfalfa, which is kind of produced to feed cows, for example. And there are a lot of these irrigation practices that are very, very wasteful, right? Because they're just flooding the fields and using a lot of water. So if there can be more pressure in making policymakers, you know, recognize this these wastages and these issues, I believe we can really make a bigger dent in water. I'm so sorry, because when you ask me about what we can do as individuals, I kind of move from our daily habits eventually into the government policies, because but I feel that as much as bottom up efforts can make a difference, like in terms of our consumerist kind of habits, the biggest effect is through industry wide practices, because at the end of the day, about I think 8 to 9% of the water is being used by us for our daily needs. 70% is used in agriculture and 22% is used in industry. So if we really want to change our relationship with water and also to make sure that we are putting sufficient change in the system, individual habits, as much as they are very important, is not sufficient. You know, we really need kind of everybody, every part of society, the people, the private industries and the public government, governments, to institutions to do things about it as well. So well, yeah, I hope I answered that question.
You did. No, that makes a lot of sense to me. And I'm sure Samantha agrees as well, because you need both the personal and the policy to kind of work together, and they're complementary, right? And it's when I'm listening to you share very eloquently about the three big ideas, right? To remind listeners about changing mindsets on water scarcity, valuing the true worth of water, and leveraging upon, you know, innovation to solve the water crisis, right? We're focused a lot on that so far. We now want to kind of frame it in relation to your work at your social enterprise at Water Roam, right? So in terms of the future of Water Roam, so in the near-term future, let's say in the next 5 years, where do you see Water Roam in the next 5 years, and how would you position Water Roam in relation to those three big ideas you've shared so far?
Where will we see Water Roam in the next 5 years? At Water Roam, what we are very focused on is making sure that the bottom of the pyramid, or those who are who don't have access to clean water, get access to them. Our big goal by 2030 is to be able to provide 30 million people with clean water. I know that that number is not huge, you know, because right now there's 2 billion people. We believe there'll be more who don't have access to it. But as a small player, we feel that that's like kind of the minimum we need to do in order to make sure that there is significant impact relative to what we can do. So for us, our focus is a lot on providing solutions to disaster-stricken areas and rural regions. I think the rural regions is kind of understandable, but let me talk a little bit why we are also having a big focus on places where it is disaster-stricken. Because of climate change, I know cliche, right? Talk about climate. Everyone just talks about climate change, but because of climate change, weather patterns are getting more and more unpredictable. So for example, in India, they're getting more rain. So that's a good thing, right? But the rain is only coming during the monsoon season where it is already very wet. So you already have a lot of water and now it's flooding, right? And during the dry seasons, it continues being very dry. And the issue when things like that happen is that it creates a very huge issue. Like for example, in India, many parts of India actually use is actually into agricultural things. And when there's so much rain, their harvest gets, their storage and harvest gets affected. And during the dry season, their crops don't survive for harvesting. And this actually creates a lot of pressure for people living in these communities. And because of climate change and because of the increasing frequency of things like droughts and water-related kind of disasters, floods, is actually causing more conflicts worldwide. So let me give you an example. So in 2006, there was this huge... The Syrian war happened around, I think, the 2010s, right? But a lot of times, a lot of analysts would believe that actually a major drought was one of the drivers for a huge migration of people. And it's extremely tragic. What happened is that there are so many people who have to move because they have no water. And that causes a lot of friction between the communities and society. And it ended up into a civil war. And right now, there are so many people who are living in refugee camps where they don't have any proper infrastructure and where there is no, they have no basic access to water. And going back to why I talk about this was because of climate change, because of how the seasons are changing and the weather, the climate is less predictable, the weather patterns are more extreme. We are seeing more and more people who are affected by it, and people who are affected by it are usually the marginalized groups. And what we want to do is to make sure that these people are able to get respite. We are building water filtration solutions that can be used in some of these places, these refugee camps, so that people can still get access to clean water. And we are also designing them in a manner that is more durable. So for example, where we are releasing a Mark II probably at the end of the year, these systems is a lot more robust and a lot more durable, and they can be used from disaster relief all the way to, you know, when they kind of move out and things go back to normalcy, where they can live in their homes in the rural area, rural developing area. So we have a very huge focus on that right now. And our core belief is that everyone should have access to clean water. And I feel that we need to be prepared for that. We need to be prepared for what's coming.
And you've painted this picture for the next 5 years, right? Actually, to 2030, so about 8 years, right? This next question is kind of unfair because you talked about instability and unpredictability, but because we're focused on the future, right, I'm wondering, where do you see Futurome in the next 50 years? So not 2030, but maybe like 2072. Where do you see the social enterprise and the work that you're doing in the next 50 years?
Yeah, I think the next 50 years is really interesting. I'm like 30, 31 now, so I'll be 80 by then. You know, I hope that by then, I'm sure someone else will be doing what I am and probably doing better. But I hope that by 2080, right? No, but 2070, 2080, I hope that by then, there's no need for water room to exist. You know, we have found a way to manage the water crisis well enough. Everyone have universal access to clean water. And, you know, people can be moving into areas like finding cure for incurable diseases right now, for AIDS, for cancer. And we are all using renewable energies as much as we can. And the earth is not warming up to more than like 3 or 4 degrees Celsius, which is, I mean, right now we are on track on achieving that. I mean, well done for us. But yeah, I feel that if by then, you know, Water Roam, I mean, I hope that by then what we can provide, you know, maybe we are a player in the water field where we are just providing everybody with clean water, right? In their homes, you know, places everywhere will have clean water, and Water Roam is part of that process. It's part of, we're a small gear in the cog in that huge process, right? In that huge system. And I think that is where I hope Water Roam is, because I mean, it's a little bit self-greedy of me to want to achieve it within my lifetime, but I think if you're not there by 2080, then I think it's quite disappointing. Or 2070 or 2080. I think we'll be looking at some other problems by then. And we as a civilization, we as a society, is able to recognize the problem well enough such that we won't be facing these problems now. Every home will have a tap. Yeah, that's what I want.
That's a great vision. I hope so too. So I think it's always interesting to talk to founders of organizations, because who they are is such a big part of the organization that they build, and the organization that they build is also a huge part of who they are. So let's turn to the personal. And so my question for you is that in terms of the future of you, Chongtae, thinking back to the past 2 years, how has COVID-19 affected your work, especially since you've traveled so frequently across the region around the world?
Yeah, I think when COVID hit in 2020, when the entire aviation industry kind of just went on the lockdown and we all can't fly, borders are closed, it definitely affected our work, because we can't travel, we can't go down onto the ground. And we used to do most of our training activities all offline. We spend a lot of time with the communities, you know, educating them about the system, talking about water. So we don't just teach them how to use the system, we kind of show the value of water, value of clean water to them. And, you know, I believe that we were able to do things very, very effectively because of being on the ground and being able to connect with these people, being able to understand them and hoping to be able to change their minds. When COVID hit, we can't travel, which means that a lot of these things that we were able to do in the past can't be done face-to-face. What we did was we pivoted to digital solutions. So we started making a lot of video content and material. And then we did a lot of online training courses. We kind of do an online webinar where we get in all the various stakeholders from the communities, from partners that we have, distributors we have in countries like Indonesia and Philippines. And we train them digitally, right? We train them through virtual conferences. And we do that to make sure that they are able to still get the knowledge and information that they need. So that is one way that we use to kind of lessen the impact of the inability to travel to some of these places. The other thing that we did was also to find more ambassadors, you know, local champions on the ground to be able to continue our work. So these are people that we train up, people that we kind of teach to make sure that they can be our champions on the ground. They can continue championing the work that we do. We have built this system that allows them to be able to reach out to various communities to deploy the water filters so that people can still get clean water. So we work a lot with partners from Myanmar, Indonesia, to make sure that we are still able to provide clean water during that period. And yeah, so that is actually a lot of the things that we have done. And right now, we are still supplying filters to various regions. One of them, more actively, is in Myanmar. And we will continue doing what we do, you know, even though there's COVID, and we hope to be able to travel down soon.
Thanks for sharing that. I think the international aspect and the underground part of the work is really what's very exciting to hear about, because it makes the work very real, especially when it's like an issue that seems far away. So speaking of Myanmar, you spend a lot of time in Myanmar, as you mentioned, and we know the messy social political situation in the country right now. So I'm curious to know, how have you and Water Roam navigated the present circumstances, and how has experiences been for you?
Yeah, I think, you know, like, the last 2 years have been a difficult year for all of us, right? Because COVID-19 struck. And I think at this point, we are all vaccinated. I think things are kind of moving a little bit better. But this really has not been the case for Myanmar. And that is also because of the military coup that was started in February 2021. Yeah. So Myanmar is one of the biggest country. Let me talk a little bit about Myanmar, because I feel that not a lot of people know about the history of it. You know, it's one of the largest countries in Southeast Asia, and it's bordered by Bangladesh, India, China, Laos, and Thailand. And for most of its independent years, actually, the country has always been subject to very rampant ethnic strife at the borders. So even before the military conflict happened, there has been a lot of inter-ethnic conflict, particularly between the people of Karen State, and with the central government. So many of these states are not, I would say, not in the best terms. But of course, we all know about Aung San Suu Kyi, and we know about how democracy has thrived in Myanmar for the last 10 years before the coup. And I think things have gotten a lot better for them over the last 10 years, and you can see that there's a lot of progress being made. But even then, many of these people who are living in this area already have some of the worst health outcomes in the region. You know, if you look at some of the statistics from UNHCR, there's about 1 million people who are currently escaping persecution, and then I think out of this 1 million people, about, I think close to 10 million or 9 million of them, I think about 9.6, 9.7 million people do not have access to clean water. And that's about 1 in 5 Burmese. Can you imagine, like, if you are in wherever you are now, and every time you walk past 5 people, one of them actually don't have basic access to clean water. So we started working with our partners in Myanmar since about 2019. So we have been working with Safe Water for Every Child to provide clean water to a lot of the remote communities and rural areas. But because of the civil conflict or civil war, they wouldn't want to say it's a war, but it's a civil war, right? So because of the military coup and the civil war that's happening right now, we were forced kind of to shift our efforts from rural development into kind of disaster relief, right? So basically, because of the bombings, the artillery shelling that's happening at the borders, it has kind of led to an exodus of a biblical scale. Like, people were all trying to get across the Salween River into Thailand. And traditionally, Thailand and Myanmar has very, very good relationships. And the Thai people has been very welcoming, accommodating to them. They kind of just are separated by this river, right? So the people generally have a lot of relationship with each other. But because of COVID, the type of things that the Thai people could do is often also limited because of border security and things like that. What we're doing right now is that we are working very closely with Safe Water and also with some of our partners, our Burmese partners who are living along the borders in Myanmar and Thailand. We are sending our water filters along with wash kits, complimentary wash kits, sanitary devices, tools and equipment that is used for maintenance of the water filters, and we are sending them through the humanitarian corridor from Thailand, right? Right now, we have impacted, I think so far, more than 10,000 people who are living in the refugee camps. And these emergency water filters are also used to provide some of their most basic needs, to make sure that they have clean water for showering, for drinking, and for cooking. And WaterRoom, what we do is we work with private partners, private donors, who kind of raise funds for these communities, because at the moment, they don't have the ability to fully provide for some of the most basic things they need. Along with time, some of the other things that we are trying to do is also we have a few fundraising efforts that's ongoing right now on GiveAsia. So we also kind of amass some of this support from the public, and we use them for to fund some of the kind of the wash aid and basic aids that they need, emergency aid that they need to be able to continue living on the ground. Of course, I think what we hope is that the government can listen to the will of the people and a peaceful transition can happen such that the people can kind of go back to their lives as per normal again. And of course, we're not just talking about people living in Yangon City, because, I mean, people there are kind of going through their life right now, and things there seems to be some kind of peace and serenity, I would say, because, like, things aren't the worst, but we're talking about the whole country, right? And actually, a lot of the people I know in Myanmar actually feel a lot for it. Many people are actually part of the civil disobedience movement, and they don't really agree with what the current government is doing now and the current junta is doing now, Tamadaw. And I really, really hope that the current establishment and government can recognize this and a peaceful transition can happen so that, people can live their lives again and they don't need to be living in refugee camps where there's not enough water and there's not enough shelter, there's no vaccines for them. And they have to do all this while going through a pandemic. I think at WaterRoom, we are providing the technology and the know-how to make sure that they can get clean water. But I hope that, you know, as much as we're doing work in a very niche area, more people can be aware of this and more people can do something about it, you know, maybe through a friend that you know, through some of the charities that are out there that are supporting these people, because I think they really need it. Yeah, so I kind of digress a little bit talking about Myanmar, because I felt like I think not enough people know about them. And just as many news, right, it kind of gets sweeped, you know, sweeped across and then kind of like blanketed over with the next big thing that is happening right now. But the people right there, right now, they are suffering. Many of them are suffering and they're not going through the best time of their lives right now. And I hope that more people can be aware of that. And, you know, through whatever efforts, if you want to support Water Room, that'd be great. But even through your own friends and connections, through other charities and organizations, you can do something about that. I think that would be very much appreciated by the people there, I believe.
Yeah, you've expressed a lot of my own sentiments when it comes to Myanmar too, because I used to do work there many years ago, investing in agriculture businesses there. And the people that I met in Myanmar have been like some of the nicest, warmest, most welcoming people. And it really feels very disheartening to see them suffer for things that were not the choice that they had no part in. So, you know, definitely I would love to like second your call for support with the communities on the ground and the people who are suffering. Yeah, so I'd like to just, we'd just like to end off with a question that we all ask all our guests. So, you know, you've shared a lot, your own journey, the work of Water Room, the future of water, water scarcity. So knowing what you know now, through all your years of experience, what is the one thing you will tell a younger Chongti who was just starting out at Water Room?
One thing I'll tell myself. I've done so many things wrong that I wish that that I can correct them if I can, you know, tell a younger Chongti. But I would say, stay humble, be adaptable. You know, I think the only way to get through all of this is to constantly reinvent yourself. You know, don't never be satisfied with the status quo. I don't think I am right now, but I would remind him that, right? Because there's still so much that we can do. And yeah, I think I'll tell him to be able to continue doing what he's doing, because I think that never changed after all these years.
You know, and on that note, I would say a very big thank you for helping us kick off the Future Off series on the podcast. Thank you for spending time sharing about your experiences with Water Room, your big ideas, your personal experiences, including in Myanmar, which I think all folks should pay attention to. And, you know, thank you for all the work you've been doing. I'm sure folks will be really interested to find out more. And then, yeah, thank you so much for being with us today.
Yeah, thank you. And maybe I'll just end up by saying that, you know, we can afford a lot more empathy in the water space and in humanity in general. So let's do that.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Chongti.